Hello, it's Alice Arnold here. Welcome to the Magic Musicals and Theatre Podcast. And this week I'm talking to the stars of the play Pressure, David Haig and Laura Rogers. I'm backstage with David Haig at the Ambassador's Theatre. Now, last time I was doing a podcast, I was at the Palladium, which was palatial.
This isn't. No,
David, it's not. We're quite a compact,
it's
should I
very
say,
compact.
For the number one dressing room.
Well, quite. And yes. A number one dressing room that I share with Malcolm Sinclair. I'm very happy to share it with him too. But as I was telling my wife, it is our dressing room is smaller than our double bed.
It is really tiny.
It is minute.
It is. Now, David Haig, I am a massive fan of yours.
Oh, well, that's just very nice to hear. Thank you.
Ever since Portrait of a Marriage, really.
Oh, wow.
When I just loved you in that because you made me cry so much.
It was a good story.
It was fabulous. And then I've just followed your career ever since and everything that you've been in. I go, David Haig's in that. I'm going to watch that.
Thank you.
So I came, of course, to watch the show that you have written and star in, Pressure. And you've done lots of comedy as well in your career.
Yeah,
this is not comedic.
There's humour in it.
There is humour in it. Yeah. It's very relevant to me because I was the voice of the shipping forecast for 20 years on Radio 4.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yes. So I sort of understood because Pressure. Well, do you want to explain what it's about?
Yeah. Well, Pressure is about the weather forecaster for D-Day. The Allied weather forecaster for D-Day. And boring though that might sound, it's not actually, because he essentially saved Europe by persuading Eisenhower to delay D-Day by 24 hours because he saw appalling storms, June storms, coming into the channel, which would have capsized all the landing craft because they were flat-bottomed, and we could have lost between 40 and 80,000 lives. And all the American weather forecasters thought it was going to be a glorious sunny day. And this very dour, tenacious Scot, James Stagg, stood his ground and persuaded Eisenhower. The following day, his true genius was revealed because he noticed that a storm was slowing down off Newfoundland. So he went back to Eisenhower and he said, look, I told you yesterday to delay, but if you go tomorrow, you might have an 8-hour window. And the rest is history.
It's kind of the opposite of the Michael Fish story, isn't it?
It's sort of
the opposite. When you were right, he was right.
Well, Michael enjoyed it. He came to see it twice.
Did he?
Yeah.
Bless him. I'm sure he's fed up of people talking about that. But it's quite technical about the weather. What I loved about it, because we do actually see the pressure pattern maps.
Yeah.
On the screen.
Yeah.
Well, they're giant, 10 foot by 8 foot maps.
They're the backdrop, really, aren't they?
They are, and we can see, especially if you slightly understand the weather, which I love the weather, and pressure maps, you can see where that sort of space is, where there was a window for sort of 6 hours.
Absolutely.
On the 6th of June. Otherwise, we would have all been, well, we wouldn't have been celebrating D-Day, would we? I don't know what we would have been doing if it had happened on the 5th.
The war would have gone on for years.
And what first drew your attention to this story?
The play's origins were a commission by the Royal Lyceum in Edinburgh, probably 5 years ago now, and they wanted a Scots story, an unsung Scots hero. And John Dove had a book of unsung Scots heroes, and we researched it, and I thought, the moment I started researching Stagg, I thought it was absolutely irresistible. And then, through Stagg, discovered a lot about Eisenhower and his extraordinarily moving relationship with Lieutenant Kay Summersby, who Laura Rogers plays, and this interdependent relationship that Churchill and Roosevelt, everybody, supported because they kept Eisenhower calm. So those three are the sort of points, Stagg, Summersby, and Eisenhower, really the three emotional points of the story.
And when you wrote it, you didn't think you were originally going to play Stagg, did you?
That's right, and I'm not being disingenuous here, I genuinely didn't see the character as anything to do with me, and we asked two very famous Scots if they'd like to play it. One of them was too busy. The only reason they said no was because they'd played a lot of terse, dour Scots over the years and didn't want to do that anymore and didn't want to be tied down to that reputation. So I'll leave your listeners to try and work out who that was.
Right. So, because I was going to, because you wrote the play as well as starring in it, and now obviously you didn't write this part for you because you didn't think you were going to play it. But when you, are you speaking as an actor, writer? Are you speaking the lines for yourself? Are you?
It's a very strange process being in your own play. I did do it before when I did My Boy Jack. I wrote My Boy Jack and played Rudyard Kipling in it on stage and the television. And so I was used to it once the producers this time round asked. But it is an odd feeling speaking your own lines. And the amusing thing is, because John Dove, the director, wonderful director who directed both this and My Boy Jack, occasionally I'd sort of turn to him and spontaneously say, I just don't get this. Why does he say this? And then I realise, of course, well, if I don't know why he said this, then nobody's going to, because
so
I wrote
you,
it.
So did you change it at all in rehearsal?
Very, very little, and usually structurally rather than because a line didn't sound right in itself. But yes, I mean, John and I worked sort of, terrible word coming up, organically on that as the rehearsals went on, yeah.
And although the play is about the D-Day landings, I think, well, my favourite moment in it, there's a scene quite near the end when your character and Eisenhower's characters actually talk about personal loss.
Yeah.
And it's the relationship between personal loss and mass loss in war,
yeah,
I suppose.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And what you both do is bring that home.
Oh, well,
to,
you can come again,
because
that's the most important moment to me in the play.
Is it? Well, I love that, and it seemed like that was very personal to you.
Yes, it is.
To put that in.
Yeah, because I lost a sister when she was 22 from a brain hemorrhage, and I also lost a baby. We had a stillbirth. So I've always been fascinated, is quite the wrong word, but truly interested in the nature of loss. And as you say, that relationship within war of mass loss, aspiration, camaraderie, but always in the background, the potential devastation of loss.
And it was interesting that Eisenhower, although, you know, commanding thousands of troops, did see the personal, because I think that most people think that generals, it's a loss in terms of numbers. We want it to be 7,000 rather than 40,000.
Exactly.
And
actually, indeed,
each one of those matters.
Each one matters. And as I say in the play, if anybody out there who's experienced a loss in family or a loved one knows how widely the repercussions reverberate, you know. And I call it in the play the chain reaction of grief, because it spreads to everybody those people know and can last a lifetime. Mm-hmm. So imagine that on a scale of 50,000 dying.
Right, well, we'll move away from that.
Yeah, let's.
From that, yeah. But you talked about the similarities between you and James Stagg covering up anxiety.
Yeah.
With this sort of confident exterior.
Yes, bonhomie.
Do you suffer from that?
I do. I mean, yes, I think my family would confirm that there is a similarity, that that whatever is on the surface thinly disguises a sort of mind that never stops angsting about this, that and the other. Mm-hmm. And tries to stay in control of it, but not always successfully.
But that's
life, isn't it?
Yes, and the joy of acting. If you were totally in control of it,
it wouldn't be as exciting or interesting, would it?
Now, your first play was also about war.
Yeah.
Is this a theme with you? Have you always had a sort of fascination for military history?
No, it just happens to be that those two are the most successful plays. I did one in between called The Good Samaritan, which was about the Samaritans. Again, I suppose, touching loss, this time suicide, so let's not get maudlin about that, but so I suppose there is a link there. But the two war ones have been the most successful, which is interesting, for the reasons I was saying earlier, you know.
And you've written for the stage. Would you write for television or film?
Well, My Boy Jack was filmed.
Okay.
So, and I'm hoping.
But would you write originally for?
Hoping that this will
should
be filmed.
Well, this should. Oh, absolutely, it should be. I mean, you can.
It sort of feels filmic.
It really does.
But we'll see. It took me 11 years to get My Boy Jack filmed, and I'm only up to 3.5 years with pressure. So I'm sort of on the foothills of
development. So when I'm 70, we might see the film of this. You never know. I'll probably get a free pass to the cinema by then.
Now, I've got my free train one.
Have you?
Oyster. I'm 62 now. That is the most pleasurable, simple pleasure in life, is going through those machines,
and it's free.
For free.
60, that
I'm sure we don't really deserve it now at 60, because 60 is quite, well, touch wood, relatively young now. But I mean, what a feeling.
But anyway, that's bye-bye, yeah, bye, really. Now, so you've got 5 children.
I have.
Are any of them involved in theatre and
yes,
the same profession?
Yeah, my eldest, Alice, is an actress. She's just finished an Agatha Christie tour, which she enjoyed very much. And my third is an actor, Fred, and he's just started, relatively speaking, he's been going 18 months, and has just finished Follies at the National Theatre, which was a huge success.
We saw it.
And, well, there you go, he was one of the 4 young ghost figures.
Oh, right.
It? Yeah. And he's doing a couple of episodes of the new Stephen Polyarkov series, so he's very excited about that. That's great.
They're both doing
but
well.
The other three are safely not in the
They've
profession.
Safely got a normal
yeah.
a normal living. Yeah. You haven't got to worry so much about them. Now, this play runs, it's a limited run, only till the 1st of September.
Yeah, we have been doing it since January.
Yeah. Right.
Around the country.
All right.
So
we're late to the party, us at Magic. Do apologise
no,
for that.
No, not at all.
What's on the horizon for you, apart from a holiday, hopefully?
Well, we're nabbing a week because my wife works, and so we have to find these times carefully. But then what I'd love to do is write through the winter, and I've got a couple of ideas and a couple of meetings coming up, which possibly, touch wood, would afford me that. And that's what I'd like to
and
do.
And are you disciplined about that? Do you go to your desk every go write?
Pretty much, but it doesn't
day
have to be a desk. I like writing outdoors when it's hot, or in the corner of the living room if I get cozy. You know, I mean, it doesn't have to be place specific, which is interesting because a lot of writers like that, don't they?
Yeah.
But no, as long as I can get my mind into another place, I'm fine. It doesn't matter where it is.
And I can see the excitement on your face about hoping that you're going to spend the winter writing rather than the winter touring in a production of whatever you would rather
be
writing.
Well, also this part is predicated on tension, really, the James Stagg part. So 9 months of that, I feel it would be nice to just sit behind a computer for 3 months.
Yeah. And relax a little bit.
Yeah.
Because as someone who, as you confess, has an bubbling under anxiety and insecurity and all of that, you've chosen a profession which is just rife with it, basically.
Absolutely, yeah.
So you haven't got to wait for the phone to ring. You've got your meetings.
Yes, I've got meetings. I've got meetings next week, which are very exciting meetings.
Now, usually I talk about, just to interrupt you, cupcakes at the beginning of my interviews. I don't think this was recorded because I did give you some cupcakes.
Would you
like to explain what you've done with them?
I've hidden them so that Laura Rogers, who was going to share them with me, doesn't immediately see them. Then I will feel guilty and I will take them next door and offer her at least one of the 4.
Well, if she heard this podcast, she would know then, you see.
Yeah.
So your secret would be out.
It'll be out and I'll never be trusted again.
No. David, thank you
so much.
I know you're off for a haircut now.
I'm off for a haircut and then 2 shows.
And then 2 shows. That's it's a heck of a part. So 2 shows is woof. But we absolutely loved it when we saw it. It's the most intense but beautiful and moving and wonderful story.
Thank you for telling it. Well, thank you for having me.
I've now moved next door to another dressing room to speak to Laura Rogers. I've left David Haig to have his hair cut. David might want to say something to you when he next sees you about something that's on one of his shelves. I'll just tell you, it's on the shelf in his dressing room.
Mm-hmm.
And it's part of it is for you.
Oh.
Whether that is given to you or not.
Ah.
I can't. That sort of seems to be up to him now.
Right. Oh, well.
So,
I'll get it off him, whatever it is.
Yeah. cupcake. Anyway, Laura Rogers, we're backstage still at Pressure.
Mm-hmm.
You've been with this production since the very beginning, haven't you?
Really? I have.
You were at the inception.
I was.
How did that come about in Edinburgh, wasn't it?
Yes. Well, it was about 4 years ago now, maybe even a bit longer than that. And as with every job, really, I got a call from my agent and a script was sent my way and I read the script, went in and met the director.
And we should explain who you play, really. Would you explain who you play?
Yeah, I play Kay Summersby, who, as I say, was a real-life woman. Unfortunately, she's no longer alive. She died in 1975, I believe. And she was Eisenhower's right-hand woman, driver, PA, confidant, and, as we are led to believe, and I personally believe, love interest.
Yes, it's interesting. If you do any research on it, mm-hmm. there are mixed things, aren't there? I mean, they clearly had an incredibly close relationship.
Yeah, that was not ever in doubt. No. And everybody was aware of the closeness of their relationship. But because she kept Eisenhower very calm and she dealt with all the men very well, including, you know, Churchill and all of the people surrounding Ike, they were very discreet about her relationship with him because they knew that she enabled him to sort of do his job to the best of his ability, really. And so it is questioned as to whether anything happened sexually between them or not. But the one thing that nobody can deny is that there was a real chemistry and love and...
Yes, I think the question is consummation or not.
Consummation
really.
Or not, some people say yes. Well, some,
but definitely love.
It's so innocent. I mean, it's all just, it's all described and it's all about the ease of their relationship and the body language and the companionship within the story rather than very explicit sort of lovemaking or kissing or passion. Mm. Passionate scenes, really.
Well, it wasn't the time.
It was not the time.
No, it wasn't the time, apart from the fact that we were in the middle of a war.
I'm sure it was the time.
But was it? Did you enjoy doing the research? Had you played a real-life character before?
Let me think. I'd have to actually dig back into what I've done now. But
did that feel different?
It felt
having
different.
Having to do that research
yes.
that it was based on something. You didn't have to make it up.
Yes, exactly. And I think what was great about it was because it was a new play and... To originate the part meant that actually I wasn't copying or following anyone else. I hadn't seen anyone else play her, so I didn't have an imprint stamped into my head, and so I couldn't imitate anybody else. And she's so beautifully written. I read an autobiography called Eisenhower Was My Boss that she wrote while she was still alive and whilst Eisenhower was still alive. I mean, obviously. While she was still alive, but before she got ill. And so that was very much about their working relationship. And she comes across as just being, you can hear this incredible character come across. She was very witty and bright and, you know, strong-willed, fiery, passionate, but very efficient, but also very well-loved between amongst everybody she worked for. So her nephew came to watch this, as did her sister-in-law, who's now in her early 90s, and they both said what a fiery personality she was, but what a great laugh she was, and how everybody just loved her company. And so that really came across from her books. And I just thought that she has such a fascinating... She played such a major part in the war, like so many women did, in that era that go unrecognised. And she really facilitated and enabled these men in power to be able to just do the job to the best of their ability. And of course these women are forgotten about, and once the war came to an end she had to sort of go back to her normal life, as lots of women do. And I think that she felt as that there was a real purpose for her. When the war was on, she learned major skills. She was a driver. She knew how the ins and outs of a car engine, and they were used. And then I think that she felt sort of redundant afterwards.
Yes, it was rather sad to hear about the end of her life, wasn't it? She married someone who married her for money, and he ran off, and then she got divorced.
Then she never had any children, which is one of the running themes throughout the play, that I think that she was desperate to have a child, and I think probably that she would have loved to have had one with Eisenhower, but that was never going to be on the cards. But when she died of cancer. She wasn't particularly old, I don't think, and she was in her 60s, and this was in 1975. In her purse, they found a note that she'd kept from Eisenhower, and it said something along the lines of, "Dear Kay, there are so many things I wish to say. You know what they are, or you know them." Mm. And I just thought that's so heartbreaking to think that she never got over that love, and she never got over that time in the war. And I think these women, it's a real privilege to just be portraying her.
Yeah, and giving her the credit now,
yes,
that she probably didn't get at the time. Exactly. Although she was decorated in the war, I mean, she got medals and things. You're playing, obviously, well, you're with you're Eisenhower's driver, but mm-hmm. obviously you have a lot to do with David Hayes' character. Mm-hmm. How is it acting opposite the author?
Well,
is
in
it
fact,
different?
It's... No, he's been amazing because... you just forget that he's written it, and he sort of doesn't wear his writer's hat. He never did in the rehearsal room. He was very good at letting the director, because the director had worked with him for about 2.5 years, I think, on the script. So David would go and write scenes, and then he'd send the scenes in a little brown envelope or an A4 size envelope to John Dove, who would then go through some scenes and make some suggestions and then write a few notes and then pass them back to David, and David, this is what I've come to learn anyway. And so they both sort of collaborated on it together. And so David really entrusted John, and they both had a real trust between them, that they were both on the same wavelength when it came to the script and the story. So David was very good at letting John take control in the rehearsal room. And if David did have a suggestion and John went, no, I don't think that, David was very good at accepting that. But of course then there'd be times where John would say, actually, could we do a little rewrite here or there? But David never, ever tried to suggest anything in terms of how we played our characters. He was just being David the actor. Mm-hmm. In the room. Yeah.
Now, going back to your roots, Laura, you were born in Carmarthen, which you have lost your accent.
Well, yes. Yes, yeah.
Gone. Did that go when you came to London? Or?
Well, I was born in Carmarthen and lived for the first 4 years in Aberystwyth, but then moved to Swansea at the age of 4. And my mum is from Surrey, and I was brought up by her. So I've never really had a particularly strong Welsh accent, and I think it does come back a bit when I'm around other Welsh people, when I go home, when I get angry or passionate or drunk.
Yep.
It comes back. Or as soon as somebody says, you don't have a Welsh accent, then it comes out a bit stronger. But yes, I've been living here now since I was 18, so...
Was that a big culture shock coming from Swansea?
It was... I mean, yeah, I was kind of in denial, I think, because I went to RADA I got in when I was 17, and I went when I was 18. And for the first year, the youngest people and people from abroad were given halls of residence. So UCL, we used UCL halls. And it was right by where RADA was, or where RADA is, just off Tottenham Court Road. So we were right in the thick of everything. And I remember just thinking, I can't sleep because there's constantly police cars and fire engines and noise and hubbub. And I couldn't, and I was incredibly homesick for the first term. So it was a culture shock. It was before mobile phone, well, before I had a mobile phone. So I'd have to go to a phone box and do sort of put in this code that my mum had given me so that I could phone her for free.
Like reversing the charges.
Yes, yes. That sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But it was like a little BT card or something. And so I'd be just on the phone to her several times a day crying. And I hadn't really appreciated how lucky I was to be right in the centre in zone one, not having to pay for any travel and, you know, walking into my place of study. But as soon as Christmas came round, I was loving it so much that I didn't really want to go home. So I adjusted pretty quickly, but it was a completely different way of life, really. But now I've adopted it as my home, and I couldn't really imagine living in it. It's brilliant going back to Swansea to see my mum and to be by the sea and see friends and family there, but I couldn't imagine myself leaving London now.
And the other place you've done a fair amount of work is at the Globe, haven't you? You've done, been lucky enough to do, because lots of actors go their whole career and don't really do any Shakespeare.
Yeah, I know.
But you've managed to. Do you enjoy working in that space?
Yes. I hadn't done it. I actually was one of the few people, I think, that went to RADA and didn't actually do any Shakespeare there. I mean, we did.
Must have done a term.
Well, we did a term, yes. And I think, I can't remember now, I think we did a term studying a bit of Comedy of Errors. But when it came to the third year where we do the plays for the public, I wasn't in the Shakespeare play. I was in the Noel Coward play. So I didn't get to do any, perform any Shakespeare in front of anyone. And yet one of my first jobs was at the Globe doing Shakespeare. And actually when one job led to another, led to another. And suddenly I was doing Shakespeare. I thought, I'm going to have to learn how to do this then, because I still don't understand iambic pentameter or anything else. So you do learn on the job, but at first, yeah, that space, I do remember thinking, because I was 22 or 23 when I got my first job there, and I, when I was about 10, on the television I'd seen Annie Lennox performing at Hyde Park or something, and I just remember seeing those crowds and how, what an incredible feeling it must have been to be her. And so getting up on that stage and seeing not quite as many crowds as, you know, Annie Lennox had, but I thought, this is probably the closest I'll ever feel to being Annie Lennox.
Oh, yeah. That is a take on it. Now, what do you have a part that you would love to play that you're, that obviously you haven't done yet, but would, well, your dream role?
I think, I mean, I'd love to be in something like a prime suspect, a Helen Mirren in a prime suspect, that sort of a character, because I love anything to do with thrillers, crime dramas, murder mysteries, all those sort of things. And I'd love to depict like a strong woman leading the force. But in terms of theatre, I absolutely love singing. I love musical theatre. I'm not a trained dancer. And but coming from South Wales, we had the opportunity to be in choirs and everybody sang as soon as they came out the womb. So
yeah,
I think any director I work with, I always say, please, please, will you direct Cabaret? Because I want to be Sally Bowles. And I think I must have been saying it now for about 15 years. And so far, nobody has taken me up on the offer. But I'm still waiting.
Well, if anyone's listening to this podcast, any directors out there, folks, there's a Sally Bowles waiting, just itching to do the part. You finish this on the 1st of September.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a holiday, I hope, after this?
Oh, do I have a holiday? Well, it all depends, really, as we always say, with work. If I get another job, which I'm too tempted by and I can't turn down, then I'll be doing that. I often think that for actors, when they're in a job they love, that is their holiday. It's waiting for the work that's when you sort of feel like you're employed in sort of the mundane trying to get something. But
it's really hard.
Well, if you're out of work, you don't have the money to go. When you're in work, you do, and you don't have the time. So you do have to just go very spontaneously, I think.
Well, thank you so much for talking to us in your tiny little dressing room. We can open the windows now and let some air in.
Yeah, no, don't say that. It's a huge dressing room.
We've been heating you up massively. Have a great two shows
today.
And thank you so much
for giving
us your time. I'm Alice Arnold, and that was the Musicals and Theatre podcast. If you enjoyed that, then you can hear me every Saturday and Sunday morning from 6 till 10 on Mellow Magic, where I've lots of lovely, timeless, relaxing classics, musical numbers, and interviews.